Picture this for a second. It is, what, 3 in the morning?
Sounds about right for this kind of...
Yeah, 3 in the morning. The glow of a terminal screen is literally the only light in your room. You are wired in, tapped deep into the dark nets, and you are just staring at these endless, cascading data streams reflecting right off your retinas.
It's a very specific vibe.
It really is. And you aren't just browsing the web here. You are hunting. You're hunting for high-stakes targets. I mean, we are talking corporate mainframes, government databases, critical infrastructure grids.
The big fish.
Exactly, the big fish. And you're racing against rival hackers, people who are just as smart, just as well-equipped, and honestly, just as ruthless as you are. And all of you are vying for the exact same things. You want fame, you want influence, and you want complete systemic control.
It's a zero-sum game in that world.
Right. You are out there methodically building up these memory stacks, preparing devastating zero-day exploits. You're manipulating the public blockchain just to ensure that when the dust finally settles, everyone in the digital underground knows exactly who pulled off the biggest heist of the decade. So welcome to today's deep dive. Today, we are stepping completely out of our everyday analog lives, and we are plunging straight into the terminal.
It is an incredibly visceral fantasy to step into, honestly. That whole adrenaline-fueled rush of being a notorious hacker operating just purely on intellect and nerve in this digital wasteland.
And what we're looking at today to explore that fantasy is, well, it's a genuinely fascinating stack of sources.
It really is.
We've been provided with developer design documents, mechanical schemas, rule books, and even some early Kickstarter campaign drafts. And this is all from a studio called Fuzzy Robotics.
Right. They are gearing up for a 2026 release of a tabletop card game called PTSD, Terminal 01.
Terminal 01, yeah. And going through this stack of documents, I mean, it becomes immediately clear that this is not your typical, you know, casual evening of rolling a couple of dice and moving generic little wooden pawns around a board.
Not at all.
The mission for our deep dive today is to explore exactly how this game achieves something that we in the tabletop design world refer to as bleeding theme.
Bleeding theme, that's a great term.
We want to show you how a stack of cardboard actually pulls off this magic trick. We aren't going to get bogged down in dry math or hyper-specific victory point salads, right? Instead, we are looking at how every single physical component, every printed rule, every interaction you have with the cards is meticulously engineered to make you the player actually sitting in a chair, genuinely feel that specific fantasy.
We want to understand how a deck of cards scattered on a living room table transforms into a high-stakes, cutthroat turf war inside a corporate server. And that commitment to immersion is really the crux of why these documents are so compelling. Because when a game bleeds theme, the mechanics don't just describe the action textually, right? They simulate the psychological and emotional experience of performing that action.
That's a huge distinction.
Right. You aren't just collecting sets of matching colored cards. You are compiling executable code. You aren't just discarding a card from your hand. You are experiencing catastrophic data loss.
Yes.
So our goal today is to unpack the behavioral psychology behind these design choices. We want to see how the team at Fuzzy Robotics has managed to map the highly abstract architecture of a cyber attack onto physical, tangible cardboard.
So let's start right at the beginning. You sit down at the physical table, you're booting up the system, and the very first thing you have to do is establish your new digital identity.
The setup.
Yeah. The game accommodates anywhere from 2 to 6 players, promising about an hour of intense, brain-burning gameplay. But right out of the gate, you don't just sit down and say, okay, I'll play the red pieces today. You can be the blue pieces.
No, you receive a unique player card.
And these are massive, jumbo size cards, like 3.5 by 5.5 inches.
Yeah.
They absolutely dominate your personal play space. They feature an alias, which is your thematic hacker handle, a detailed backstory, and get this, a literal Polaroid style photo spot printed right on the card.
Which I love.
It's so cool. You can insert a physical picture of yourself or a drawing of your persona directly into the game.
It's a small physical detail, sure, but the psychological impact of that Polaroid slot is actually quite profound when you consider role-playing immersion.
How so?
Well, it demands that you physically bridge the gap between yourself as the player and your avatar in the game. You are not simply commanding a miniature hacker figure from on high. You're being asked to literally become the hacker.
Right. You're looking at your own face on the board.
Exactly. And mechanically, this identity isn't just cosmetic either. It's reinforced by a unique, rule-breaking special power. In-game design, giving players asymmetrical starting conditions, meaning everyone starts with a slightly different set of rules applying to them, that immediately forces players to adopt completely different mindsets and strategies from turn one.
The design documents mention powers like having a permanently expanded hand limit, or the ability to take the program action twice in a single turn instead of just once.
Which is huge.
It is. So think about what that does to your brain. If my alias has the power to program twice in a turn, I am suddenly playing as the rapid-fire coder. I'm the specialist at the table who can compile a complex exploit twice as fast as my friends.
You become the speed threat.
Exactly. It makes you feel like you have a unique backdoor into the system's logic that no one else possesses.
Yeah.
You feel specialized. You feel dangerous. But establishing your identity isn't just about who you are when you boot up the game. It is heavily defined by the choices you make once you are actually inside the network.
Right. The moment-to-moment decisions.
And that brings us to the markets. Sitting right there in the center of the board, just staring at you, are three distinct market decks. You have the Black Hat deck, the Gray Hat deck, and the White Hat deck.
This introduces a really fascinating layer to the game, one that touches on how we categorize morality and methodology in digital spaces. These three decks introduce a sort of moral shade into the fiction of the game.
Moral shade. I like that.
You aren't just drawing random event cards to see what happens. You are actively adopting a specific methodology, a very real philosophy of hacking, every single time you reach for one of those specific decks.
The flavor text and the developer notes for these decks are incredible. Let's look at the Black Hat deck first.
A nasty one.
Oh, it's brutal. It is entirely focused on malicious chaos, active sabotage, and direct attacks on other players. The developer notes explicitly state these cards are designed to ruin your opponent's plans.
They want you to play mean.
They really do. We're talking stealing critical cards right out of their hands, forcing them to discard their carefully compiled memory stacks, or even systematically removing their control cubes from a target they've already hacked. We're talking about cards that have titles like Zero Day Exploit or Rootkit.
And just to clarify those terms for anyone who might not be deep into cybersecurity jargon.
Yeah, please do.
A zero-day exploit refers to a cyber attack that targets a software vulnerability that is completely unknown to the software vendor or the antivirus vendors.
Meaning they have 0 days to prepare?
Exactly. The developers have 0 days to fix it because the attack is already happening. It's the ultimate trump card in hacking. And a rootkit is a clandestine computer program designed to provide continued privileged access to a computer while actively hiding its presence from administrators.
Just lurking in the background.
Right. So, translating that to the table, when you decide to pull a card from the Black Hat deck, you are consciously deciding to play dirty. You are choosing the aggressive, offensive route. You are actively trying to harm the other players.
Exactly. You are embracing the villain role of the network.
Yeah.
But on the flip side of that, you have the White Hat deck.
The defenders.
Right. In real-world cybersecurity, White Hat hackers are the ethical ones. They are the penetration testers hired by companies to find flaws before the bad guys do. In PTSD, Terminal Zone 1, this deck is filled with defensive patches, assists, system bonuses, and safeguards.
It's all about fortifying your own position.
Exactly. Protecting your assets rather than tearing down someone else's hard work. And then, nestled right between those two extremes, is the Gray Hat deck.
Which is arguably the most interesting of the three from a behavioral standpoint.
Oh, definitely.
The Gray Hat deck is the wild card. The developer documents describe it as purely opportunistic. It's this volatile hybrid of black and white methodologies.
So what does it actually do?
Well, it contains global system glitches and situational twists. A card from this deck might unexpectedly help you. It might inadvertently hurt someone else. Or it might completely upend the entire board state for everyone simultaneously. It is designed for the player who thrives in pure, unpredictable chaos.
What is mechanically brilliant about how you access these decks is that they are tied to a dice spot on the board. There's an 8-sided die, a D8, that is rolled during setup.
The network dice.
Yeah. And you acquire these hat cards through the game's market mechanisms, meaning you are actively, deliberately choosing which moral shade you want to inject into the live network. You are building an arsenal that directly reflects your chosen identity.
Are you going to be the defensive architect building impenetrable walls, the opportunistic glitch hunter playing the odds, or the malicious saboteur burning everyone else down?
And the game doesn't judge your morality at all. It simply hands you the tools and watches what you decide to do with them.
And implementing those tools creates incredible friction at the table. The documents detail that these cards have very specific mechanical play timings.
Meaning you don't just play them on your turn.
Right. They aren't just played on your turn. The notes mention timings like any time, including during other players' turns, or very specifically, when another player declares a hack, but before they resolve it.
Yes. Oh, man. Imagine the tension at the table with that. You're sitting across from your friend. They have been meticulously building up their attack stack for 3 full turns.
You can see the stack getting thicker.
Exactly. They are sweating. They're calculating the math in their head. They finally declare a massive hack on the Federal Reserve location card. They are about to score huge fame points. And right as they declare it, you reach into your hand and flip a Black Hat zero-day exploit onto the table, interrupting their turn, to force them to discard the most crucial piece of code from their stack.
Oh, that's devastating.
The hack fails. It's brutal. It's incredibly personal.
It perfectly captures the essence of a digital turf war. The network is not a friendly place.
No, it's not.
But while establishing your identity and your moral alignment is the foundation of your strategy, the real sweating bullets tension of this game lies in the moment-to-moment choices. It lies in what the designers call the action loop.
Right, staring down the terminal.
When you are staring down at that terminal, your tableau of cards, you have to decide what your very next keystroke is going to be.
That action loop is the beating heart of the game, so let's really walk through it for the listener. The turn structure is ruthlessly simple to understand, but agonizingly tight in execution.
Agonizing is the right word.
Because on your turn, you only get to choose to do one of 6 actions. Just one.
Not a sequence, just one single thing.
Just one. You can scan, disrupt, program, hack, harden, or blockchain. That is your entire menu. You have to evaluate the entire board state, look at the cards hidden in your hand, try to read the poker faces of your rivals, and make a single decisive move before passing the turn.
And this strict limitation of action economy is a classic, highly effective design principle used to generate psychological tension.
Because of the opportunity cost.
Exactly. When you can only do one single thing on your turn, every choice you make comes with a massive opportunity cost. If you've ever played a game where you wish you had just one more action point to pull off a combo, you know this feeling.
Oh, yeah.
You have to ask yourself constantly, do I take the scan action to dig through the network for more intelligence to build my arsenal? Because you know that while you are busy gathering data, a rival might use their turn to lock in their program and hit the exact target you were aiming for. It forces players into a constant state of hypervigilance.
Let's actually simulate what this feels like, action by action, because this is where the claim of bleeding theme really gets put to the test.
Let's do it.
Let's start with the very first option, scan. In most card games, this would just be the draw cards phase. You wouldn't think twice about it. You'd just say, I draw 2 cards and move on.
Very mechanical.
Right. But not here. In Terminal 01, you check the network scan dice that sits physically on the board. The current board state literally dictates how much data you are able to pull from the live network at that exact moment.
It's variable.
Highly variable. If that dice currently shows a 6, taking the scan action means you are downloading a massive data dump of 6 cards. But if the network has been manipulated and the dice is sitting at a 1, the network is choked. You take the scan action and you barely get a trickle of intel, just 1 card. It genuinely feels like you are tapping into a live fluctuating data stream. You are entirely at the mercy of the network's current bandwidth.
And the brilliance of that fluctuating bandwidth is how it ties directly into what I think is one of the most thematic rules in the entire rulebook.
Which one?
The hand limit. In the vast majority of card games, a hand limit is purely a structural balancing rule to keep players from hoarding half the deck and slowing down the game.
Yeah, just standard maintenance.
Right. But here, the hand limit is strictly capped at 7 cards. Always 7. And the developer documents are very explicit about the terminology used. The rulebook does not call it a hand limit.
No, it doesn't.
It explicitly refers to it as data loss.
Data loss. Oh, if you've ever tried to manage an overflowing email inbox at work, you know exactly what this mechanic feels like. You're just desperately prioritizing what's critical and trashing the rest.
Precisely. The psychological framing here completely changes how you interact with your cards. You are scanning this highly volatile network, pulling in rapid streams of data fragments. If your hand exceeds 7 cards, say the network scan dice was a 6, you had 3 cards already, and you pull this huge dump of information, you are now holding 9 cards.
Just too many.
Exactly. But you physically cannot hold all that intelligence. Your system's buffer overflows.
Just to quickly clarify for the listener, a buffer overflow in real-world computing happens when a program tries to put more data in a temporary data storage area, the buffer, than it can actually hold,
causing the excess data to spill over and overwrite adjacent memory.
It's a classic vulnerability.
It is. So in the game, your mental buffer overflows. The excess data literally slips through your fingers. You must immediately choose cards to discard down to your maximum of 7.
So painful.
You aren't just managing generic resources. You are actively experiencing the cognitive load of a hacker trying to process way too much information at once. It forces you to make agonizing, split-second decisions about what intelligence is critical to your immediate mission and what is just noise that has to be dumped into the void.
It is so incredibly evocative. Just imagine saying to your friends at the table, my buffer just overflowed. I'm experiencing data loss. As you literally throw away potentially game-winning cards into the discard pile just because your current setup couldn't handle the bandwidth spike.
It hurts.
It really hurt. And what exactly are these cards you're holding so tightly? The data cards themselves are an absolute masterclass in thematic graphic design. They aren't just pretty cyberpunk illustrations. They feature fake but highly realistic command line interface scripts.
The CLI scripts.
Yes.
For anyone unfamiliar, the command line interface is basically the text-based way you interact directly with an operating system. This is before graphical user interfaces with mice and Windows existed. Hackers live in the command line.
Right. So the design documents list examples of the text printed right on these cards. You'll see lines like decrypt underscore DD underscore B2C dot dash 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 encrypt.
Which is wonderfully accurate flavoring. The .c extension indicates a shell script, which is a program written for the command line in Unix-based systems, and it includes the command line flags, like dash dash encrypt. It looks like actual code you would type to execute a function.
And it goes deeper than just the text string. The cards also feature specific bolded fragment identifiers. We are talking hardcore technical jargon printed as the core gameplay icons.
Like what?
Like ACC for access, key AY, UTHR authentication, OSK data, info file, MEM for memory, NET, proper protocol, COIN for connection, PyE, SYS for system, core, base, alpha.
It's a massive taxonomy of digital components.
It is. And each of these fragments is tied to a specific color and a suit value. Again, Fuzzy Robotics didn't use generic playing card suits like hearts, spades, or clubs. The suits in this game are hack, crack, break, and bypass. Cyan, yellow, red, and purple.
So when you look at your hand of 7 cards, you aren't looking at a flush of hearts.
No.
You are staring at fragments of raw executable code just waiting to be assembled.
Which naturally brings us to the second action you can take on your turn, the program action. This is where you take that raw, chaotic code from your hand and start meticulously building something incredibly dangerous.
This is the buildup.
Exactly. On your physical play area, you have dedicated slots for up to 3 memory stacks. Each stack can hold a maximum of 10 data cards. When you choose to take the program action on your turn, you simply take 1 data card from your hand and place it face down into one of these 3 stacks.
And here is where the tabletop dynamics get so spicy. You aren't just playing a card to the table to get it out of your hand. You are methodically, deliberately compiling an exploit.
Piece by piece.
Every single fragment you add to that stack, maybe an authentication key on turn 1, a system bypass on turn 2, a connection protocol on turn 3, is a piece of code prepping for a highly targeted hit. You're building a weapon turn by excruciating turn.
And you're doing it out in the open, where everyone at the table can see the physical size of the stack growing, even if the cards are face down and they don't know exactly what code is in it.
The pacing created by this mechanic is critical to the game's atmosphere. Because of that strict limitation we discussed earlier, only 1 action per turn. Choosing to take the program action means you are committing valuable time and resources exclusively to building this specific weapon.
You're telegraphing it.
You are intentionally telegraphing to the entire table that you are gearing up for something major. It creates a palpable sense of escalating dread for the other players.
Oh, absolutely. They watch your stack growing thicker. 3 cards, 4 cards. 5 cards.
They know with absolute certainty that you are about to strike. The terror comes from not knowing where you're going to strike or when.
It's like loading a gun in public, 1 bullet at a time, while just staring at your friends across the table. It's intense. And while you're busy programming your little stack, completely focused on your own weapon, maybe someone else at the table takes the 3rd available action. The disrupt action.
Disrupt is wild.
It's so wild. It's the action that turns the game from a solitary puzzle into a global economic war. When you take the disrupt action, you take beta cards straight from your hand. And instead of programming them into your memory stacks to build an exploit, You burn them.
You just throw them away.
You discard them purely to use their numerical suit values, the hack, crack, break, or bypass numbers, to physically move the markers on the board's market tracks.
Taking a step back, the economic implications of this mechanic are profound.
How so?
Well, the board features six distinct market tracks: AI intel, government, financial, personal, market intel, and a wildcard track. These tracks represent the fluctuating global monetary value of different types of stolen information. By taking the disrupt action and burning your own hoarded data, you can actively manipulate these markets.
Right.
You can intentionally drive the value of financial intel into the ground, reducing it to zero, or you can spike the value of AI intel through the roof.
You are literally crashing global markets from your keyboard. You are actively shaping the entire digital environment to suit your personal agenda. Or just to spite a rival.
Usually to spite a rival.
Usually, yes. And the disrupt action doesn't stop at the markets. You can also burn cards to physically change that network scan dice we talked about earlier.
Mm-hmm.
You can artificially choke off the network right before the player next to you takes their turn, severely limiting their card draw.
That is so mean.
Or you can manipulate the SYSM crypto dice, which acts as a massive endgame multiplier.
Yeah.
You aren't just managing your own tiny hand of seven cards. You are playing God with the global digital economy.
Mm.
It is an unbelievable power trip.
It's a mechanic that perfectly encapsulates the real-world ripple effects of massive cyber warfare. A major state-sponsored hack doesn't just happen in a vacuum, quietly extracting data.
Right, there's fallout.
Huge fallout. It destabilizes international markets, it wildly affects cryptocurrency valuations, and it shifts the global geopolitical landscape. The disrupt action allows the player to weaponize the environment itself, rather than just relying on direct attacks. It introduces algorithmic flash crash dynamics right onto the cardboard.
Okay, so we have scanning, programming, and disrupting. The fourth action is harden. Let's say you've already managed to get a foothold in a specific corporate server location. On your turn, you can take the harden action by discarding a piece of matching intel from your hand.
Like a government data card for a government server?
Exactly. You discard that to place one of your physical control cubes onto that location card. This represents fortifying your backdoor access.
Yeah.
You are installing rootkits, setting up dormant administrator accounts, essentially making it significantly harder for rival hackers to push you out of that system.
Mm.
You are digging in like a digital tick.
And we will see why hardening is absolutely essential in a moment.
Yep.
Because as the rules dictate, merely breaking into a system isn't enough.
Not at all.
Maintaining long-term, fortified control of a location is the only way to truly secure your legacy and your victory points in this game. You can't just pick the lock and wander around. You have to lock a deadbolt behind you so the other thieves can't follow you in.
Exactly. And that perfectly sets the stage. Because all of these actions, the desperate scanning, the agonizing data loss of your buffer overflowing, the meticulous, terrifying programming of your memory stacks, the spiteful market disruptions, the quiet hardening of your back doors, all of it is just prologue.
It's all just building up.
It all leads to the main event, the absolute climax of the game's loop. Action number five, the hack.
Here we go.
But hacking in PTSD. Terminal 01 is not just about quietly slipping past a firewall to steal some files. It is entirely about making sure everyone in the world knows you are the one who broke the unbreakable system.
This is where the mathematical victory conditions of the game align flawlessly with the specific psychology of the hacker subculture it is attempting to portray.
The ego.
Exactly, the ego. For these characters, the ultimate goal isn't just accumulating untraceable wealth. It is notoriety. It is about fame.
Let's break down how a hack actually resolves at the table, because it is incredibly satisfying. Sitting in the center of the table are these location cards. These are jumbo cards printed in landscape orientation, taking up a lot of real estate. They represent the high-stakes targets.
The big servers.
Yeah, they have evocative names like Nexus Systems HQ or Bridger Creek Power Grid, and they're designed to be tough nuts to crack. Every location card lists a very specific set of inputs required to breach its security.
The developer documents outline the math of this in granular detail. A location might require anywhere from 2 to 5 specific inputs. Each input is a necessary combination of a fragment identifier and a suit symbol.
Give me an example.
Sure. For example, the Bridger Creek power grid might demand an authentication key played with a break suit alongside a system fragment played with a bypass suit. Furthermore, the location has a required suit value, a total number from 1 to 6, scaled based on how critically important the target is.
So a harder target needs more power.
Right. A residential apartment building's local server might only be a one, requiring minimal effort to breach. But a critical infrastructure power grid could easily be a six.
So, on your turn, you finally declare a hack. You point to the power grid. You take one of those memory stacks you've been painstakingly programming face down for the last four turns, and you push it forward. You flip the cards over, revealing your exploit to the table.
The moment of truth.
First, you have to match the required fragments exactly. Did you program an auth key? Did you program a system fragment? Second, the total numerical suit values of the cards you reveal. Remember, hack cards are worth 1 point, cracker 2, breaker 3, and bypass are 4. Those points must sum up to equal or exceed that location's required suit value of 6.
So it's a puzzle.
Yes. And third, the cards you play have to match the information type of the location. If you are hacking a government target, you need to have compiled your exploit using government data cards, unless you were lucky enough to slot in a wild card.
It acts as a complex cryptographic puzzle that you have been attempting to solve in slow motion over several turns while dealing with the chaotic interference of the other players. It's an elegant mathematical lock.
It really is.
But here is the brilliant cutthroat twist the developers added. Let's say you do the math perfectly. You succeed. Your compiled exploit breaches the firewall. The rules say you immediately place one of your colored control cubes onto the location, and you get an immediate payout of raw data cards based on the location's reward die.
Yeah, which could be a D6, D8, or D10, depending on how famous the target is.
Exactly. However, you do not automatically score the permanent fame points printed on the card.
This rule blew my mind when I read it. You only score the fame points for a location if you currently have full control of it. And the rules strictly define full control as having more of your control cubes on that specific location card than any other single player.
It is a fascinating simulation of a multi-actor breach. In the real world of cybersecurity, this mirrors the concept of advanced persistent threats, or APTs.
Advanced persistent threats.
Right. You frequently have scenarios where different state-sponsored actors or rival hacking syndicates might unknowingly occupy the exact same compromised network simultaneously. They're both lurking in the servers, constantly maneuvering for deeper access and dominance, while trying not to alert the actual system administrators to their presence.
Just ghosts in the machine fighting each other.
Precisely. The game turns this incredibly complex, real-world reality into a highly interactive, fiercely competitive mechanic.
It creates a literal turf war inside a piece of cardboard. It generates this incredible dynamic where you aren't just trying to solve the puzzle to beat the game's static security. You are actively trying to overpower the exploits your friends have already installed.
Give me a scenario.
Okay, let's say I want to hack the power grid, but you hacked it two turns ago and you have one of your control cubes sitting on it. The rules state that my memory stack now has to be even stronger. I need an extra suit point of power for every single cube my rivals have already placed on the target.
So my cube acts as a defense against you.
Yes. I have to break through the location's built-in firewall, and then I have to smash right through your custom defenses, too. And if I succeed, I place my cube. Now we are tied. Neither of us has more cubes. So neither of us gets the fame points until one of us spends a turn to harden our position and place a second cube.
It ensures that no target is ever truly safe. It forces continuous engagement. You can never just hack a location and forget about it. You have to actively defend your digital territory.
Right.
And while you are fighting these intense localized turf wars over specific servers, desperately trying to rack up fame, there is a whole other overarching layer to the endgame strategy. And this brings us to the sixth and final action you can take on your turn. The blockchain action.
The blockchain action. Now, I know what some of you are thinking. You see a lot of modern games just slap the word blockchain onto a random mechanic because it sounds cyberpunk, trendy, and tech adjacent.
It's a buzzword.
It is a buzzword. But Fuzzy Robotics actually integrated the core conceptual mechanism of a blockchain in a way that makes deep thematic sense for the game's economy. When you choose to take the blockchain action, you take one data card from your hand and you place it face up in a personal public pile on the table right in front of you. This pile is your ledger.
The absolute key detail in that rule is the phrase face up and public. Unlike your hand of cards, which is strictly hidden, or your memory stacks, which are compiled face down in secret, your blockchain pile is completely transparent.
Anyone can see it.
Every single player at the table can look over at any moment and see exactly what information you are permanently committing to your ledger.
Exactly. It serves as your cryptographic proof of possession in the ecosystem. You are essentially taking a megaphone to the darknet and announcing, "Look at this high-level financial intel I possess. Look at this incredibly rare AI intelligence I have managed to secure." You are publicly staking your ego and your reputation on this specific data.
It's pure bragging.
Pure bragging. And the reason this public bragging is so mechanically critical is how it ties into the endgame scoring.
Right. Because if we look at how this connects to the disrupt action we discussed earlier, the one where you manipulate the market values, the elegance of the game's economic design really becomes apparent. This isn't just about showing off. It's about cold, hard victory points.
Oh, hell, I'm laughing.
At the end of the game, your final score is a combination of your accrued fame from the locations you successfully hold full control over, plus a massive endgame modifier that is based entirely on the contents of your blockchain pile.
And the math for this modifier is so satisfyingly integrated with the physical board state. At the end of the game, for every single market type, so let's use market intel as an example, you look at the current position of the marker on the board's track. Maybe, after all the chaotic disruptions throughout the game, the market intel track is currently sitting at a value of 8.
Okay, an 8.
You then look down at your public blockchain pile, and you count up all the SYSM value, which is the raw currency number printed on the corners of the cards, of all the market intel cards you committed to your ledger. Let's say you committed 12 SYSM worth of market intel over the course of the game. You simply multiply the track value, which is 8, by your committed value, which is 12. That gives you 96 points.
And you do that for all the tracks.
You do that exact multiplication for all 6 market tracks, sum it all up, multiply it by whatever the final value of the crypto dice is, divide by 10 to keep the numbers manageable, and boom, that is your endgame bonus score.
I want to analyze what this mathematical formula means in actual practice at the table, because it drives player behavior in incredibly complex, vicious ways.
Oh, I know where you're going with this.
If I am sitting across from you and I see you spending turn after turn committing massive amounts of government intel to your public blockchain pile, I know exactly what your endgame strategy is. I know your final score relies incredibly heavily on the government market track maintaining a high value.
So what do you do?
Therefore, on my next turn, I might decide to forgo my own hacking plans, take the disrupt action, burn my own data, and aggressively crash the government market track down to a value of 1.
Just to ruin my multiplier.
By doing that, I effectively wipe out a huge chunk of your final score in a single spiteful keystroke.
It is so incredibly vicious. You are forced into this state of constant paranoia. You are monitoring everyone's public ledgers, trying to deduce their long-term strategy, while simultaneously trying to protect the specific markets you are personally invested in from being crashed by your rivals.
It's brilliant.
It is a brilliant, playable simulation of a volatile, speculative digital economy that is driven entirely by rumor, proof of possession, and direct targeted sabotage. The blockchain pile isn't just a point multiplier. It is your ego laid bare on the table, completely vulnerable to attack.
And crucially, it ensures that the game never devolves into what we call multiplayer solitaire,
where everyone just ignores each other.
Exactly, where everyone is just heads down, quietly solving their own puzzle. You are deeply necessarily entangled with the other player's economic strategies from the very first turn to the final whistle. The mechanics at the table genuinely, perfectly simulate a hacker's mindset. You must be paranoid, you must be opportunistic, and you must be aggressively competitive.
It really does sound like a masterpiece of tabletop tension.
Yeah.
But everything we just discussed, the memory stacks, the data loss, the market crashes, the turf wars, that all happens entirely on cardboard.
Right, on the table.
And it's great cardboard. But what absolutely blew my mind reading through these pipeline documents is what happens when you flip those physical cards over. The developers at Fuzzy Robotics took this concept of bleeding theme one massive, almost unbelievable step further. They took the theme literally off the edge of the physical table and injected it out into the real world.
This is the pivot point where PTSD, Terminal 01, transitions from being a very cleverly designed board game into something that closely resembles an alternate reality game, or an ARG, a true digital-physical hybrid experience.
Let's dive deep into the document labeled card underscores back underscores QR underscores plan dot MD. This is a highly technical pipeline document intended for the developers, and it reveals something structurally wild about how the game is printed. Every single data card and every single location card in the physical manufactured game has a completely unique QR code generated and printed on its back.
I want to pause and make sure the scale of this engineering effort is clear to you. We aren't talking about a generic, static QR code that you scan to go to the publisher's homepage to buy expansions.
Or a link to a PDF of the rulebook.
Exactly. The technical documents explicitly state that every single card has its own UUID. A UID is a universally unique identifier. It's basically a massive algorithmically generated string of characters that ensures no two things in a database are ever exactly the same.
So no two cards anywhere are the same.
Right. The game's printing pipeline generates a specific, totally unique back image for every single card in every single deck. A standard data deck has 110 cards. That means 110 mathematically unique QR codes in every box, complete with a stylistic logo composited in the center and high error correction so they scan easily under living room lighting.
Now, before anyone panics about needing an app to play a board game, I want to make this explicitly clear. This system is 100% optional. You do not need a smartphone to play the core game. You don't need an app to calculate your victory points or to resolve the math of a hack or to manage the market tracks.
It's fully playable offline.
The tabletop game we just spent the last half hour describing is mathematically complete and mechanically sound entirely offline.
Which is exactly why I initially looked at this feature with a healthy dose of skepticism.
Really?
Thematically, I understand what they are going for, but practically speaking, I have to wonder if asking players to physically pull out their smartphones mid-game fundamentally breaks the immersion of the physical table. We spend all day staring at screens, doom-scrolling, or answering emails. Isn't sitting down to play a board game supposed to be a tactile escape from that constant digital tether?
Yeah, it's a fair point.
If it doesn't change the victory math at the table, why go through the immense, costly technical hurdle of generating hundreds of thousands of unique QR codes during printing and paying to host a database to track them?
I hear that skepticism, and I totally get it. Phones at the table can be a huge buzzkill. But the answer to why they did it lies in a concept the developers call proof of exploit. It's about extending the role play.
Proof of exploit.
The document details the base URL structure that these QR codes link to. It looks something like https://sha-680401.io/card/, followed by the card's specific type and its massive UUID string. It's designed to look like a real cryptographic domain.
Very thematic.
So here's how it works in practice. When you successfully execute a massive hack on a location at the table, or when you manage to acquire an incredibly rare, legendary piece of intel in your hand, you have the option, if you want to pull out your phone, scan the QR code on the back of that specific physical card and permanently claim it on the digital layer.
Okay. When you frame it as an optional extension of the narrative, it becomes a brilliant thematic flourish. Think back to the core psychological fantasy we discussed at the very beginning of the deep dive, the hacker ego.
The bragging rights.
You want everyone to know you pulled off the heist. By choosing to scan the card, you are logging your specific achievement into the game's actual real-world live website. You are effectively saying to a global server, I, using my specific alias, successfully compromised the Bridger Creek power grid on this exact date, at this exact time.
Yes. You are leaving a verifiable digital trace on the actual real-world internet. The reality of the game is literally bleeding into our physical reality. You are no longer just winning a self-contained board game against your three friends in the isolation of your living room. You are participating in a persistent global ledger.
The world is watching.
Exactly. The bragging rights, the notoriety, and the reputation you build at the table spill out into a living digital ecosystem. Imagine finishing a grueling two-hour game, scoring the winning hack, and then going to the game's website later that night. You pull up a global timeline of hacks happening from player groups all over the world, in Tokyo, in London, in New York, and your alias is sitting right there at the top of the feed, holding the cryptographic proofs of the exploit.
From a purely technical standpoint, the level of engineering detail the creators went to just to ensure the physical cardboard perfectly bridges to a digital database without fail is staggering.
It's intense.
The documents discuss the specific scripts used. They talk about rendering n number of unique data faces and matching them perfectly to n number of unique data backs. They detail using the OCARCode library in Python, specifically setting it to level H error correction so that even if the card gets scratched or slightly bent, it still scans perfectly.
They really thought of everything.
They talk about using PIL, the Python imaging library, which is a tool coders use to programmatically edit and composite images to automatically stamp the game's logo directly into the center of the QR code without breaking its functionality. And then they outline using the Game Crafters API, which is an automated manufacturing interface, to bulk create the decks so that the front face of the card and its mathematically specific QR code back match exactly one-to-one during the physical printing process. It is a genuine engineering marvel built entirely to serve a thematic fantasy.
It is completely insane. They are using advanced Python scripts, Jinja 2 templates, which is a tool that lets coders dynamically plug variables into text files, Dash and Playwright, which is a framework for web automation that basically lets a script drive a web browser to take automated screenshots. They built an entire automated software company pipeline, all just so you, the player, can feel a tiny spark of genuine hacker adrenaline when you scan a piece of cardboard with your camera.
And it pays off.
And you know what? Reading this, I realize it works. Knowing that QR code is back there makes the physical cards feel inherently dangerous. They aren't just pieces of a game. They are physical, tangible keys to a permanent digital record.
It's an incredible undertaking, and what's truly fascinating is that this pipeline, this immense technical effort to build the game, is not something they are hiding away as proprietary trade secrets. In fact, it is the focus of the final and perhaps most mind-bending section of the documents we reviewed.
The meta layer.
Because the theme of the game hacking, open source culture, manipulating code, extends not just into the physical components and the digital logging, but into the very philosophy of how the game itself was created.
Which brings us to the file literally named pipeline.md. This might be the most fascinating single document in the entire stack we received. This document pulls back the curtain and reveals the true meta of PTSD, Terminal 01. For the last hour, we have been talking about how playing the game is a simulation of writing code, a simulation of hacking a system. But this document reveals that the game itself is actually generated from code.
The developer documents describe the project as a self-compiling game, and that isn't hyperbole. The developers at Fuzzy Robotics aren't sitting in Adobe Photoshop, manually typing in the flavor text, painstakingly adjusting the layout, and manually balancing the fragment identifiers and suit values for all 110 cards in a deck.
That would take forever.
Hundreds of hours of manual labor. Instead, they have engineered a comprehensive build pipeline using complex Python scripts, CSV spreadsheets, raw JSON data files, and even local large language models. Right, LLMs, which are essentially advanced AI text generators running locally on their own machines rather than relying on a cloud service.
That's exactly right. They detail a specific script called generate_cards.py. You can literally run this game's creation from a command line. A developer types a command like --playable-deck, inputs a desired player count. Let's say they want a deck perfectly tuned for exactly 3 players, and they hit enter. And the script just goes to work.
It just builds it.
It autonomously generates a massive pool of data cards, dynamically balancing the statistical distribution of the fragment identifiers and the suit values to ensure the math of the game works perfectly for that specific player count. Then, it triggers the LLM to generate completely unique hacker aliases, highly realistic fake CLI scripts for the card art, and context-aware flavor text for the location targets.
Context-aware meaning what?
For example, the documents mention you can provide the script with a specific real-world zip code, and the LLM will generate region-specific infrastructure targets tailored to that exact area. The script compiles the physical boards, it lays out the decks, it generates some market cards, all of it done automatically by code.
This approach raises an incredibly provocative philosophical angle regarding game design. The product itself possesses this self-aware, almost living quality to it. It is a game explicitly designed by executing code, intended for people who want to simulate being coders, which simulates the act of manipulating code.
An arbors of theme.
Exactly. But the absolute kicker, the ultimate goal of Fuzzy Robotics, as stated in their early Kickstarter drafts, isn't just to use this pipeline internally to sell you a printed box. Their stated stretch goal is to open source the entire game and the entire build pipeline to the public.
They are open sourcing the hack. If they hit their funding goals, they are going to release the core Python scripts, the HTML rendering templates, the mathematical logic algorithms, the entire GitHub repository. They are actively, intentionally inviting the tabletop community to take their proprietary code and hack the game itself.
Think about the implications of that for the community. If you play the game and decide you don't like the balance of the white hat deck, maybe you think the defensive cards are too powerful, you don't have to wait for the publisher to release a patched expansion.
You just fix it yourself.
You can open the JSON configuration file, change the numerical parameters yourself, run the Python script, and recompile a mathematically balanced, updated version of the game. If you want to create a hyper-localized version of a game where all the location targets aren't generic sci-fi names, but are the actual real-world businesses and infrastructure in your specific hometown, you can feed those local parameters into the LLM pipeline and generate a custom print-and-play PDF ready for your table in a matter of minutes.
You can remix the market decks. You can change the volatility of the crypto dice. You can invent entirely new fragment identifiers to add new layers to the puzzle, and you can share your compiled, highly customized versions with players globally. The core theme of being a hacker, of taking control of a system and bending it to your will, is perfectly mirrored in the product's real-world open-source code base.
A game entirely about hacking is, by its very structural design, highly hackable.
I truly believe it is the ultimate expression of what it means for a game to bleed theme.
It completely democratizes the design process, handing the literal keys of the developer terminal over to the players. By doing so, you are no longer just a passive consumer of a boxed entertainment experience. You are invited to become an active developer, a sysadmin governing your own personal digital wasteland. It shifts the power dynamic between creator and player in a way that is profoundly fitting for the cyberpunk genre.
So, after digging through all these schemas, all these scripts, and all these rules, what does this all mean? Let's take a step back and wrap this up, because my mind is absolutely spinning with the possibilities of what this game represents.
It's a lot to take in.
PTSD. Terminal 01 is clearly not just a collection of abstract rules about drawing cards and moving cubes on a tracker. It stands as a masterclass in deep, structural, thematic integration. From the very first moment you boot up the game and slot your physical Polaroid into your player card, cementing your digital identity.
To the moment you make that first critical choice of moral alignment, deciding whether to draw from the malicious black hat deck or the defensive white hat deck, defining your methodology.
To the agonizing, sweating bullets tension of the action loop, where your mental buffer overflows and you suffer actual data loss, forced to discard crucial intelligence simply because the network bandwidth overwhelmed your system's capacity.
To the meticulous, highly visible programming of your memory stacks, laying down fragments of raw code turn by turn, telegraphing your threat, preparing for a devastating hack against a secure location, and fighting a brutal multiplayer turf war for full control just to claim the fame.
To the spiteful manipulation of the market tracks, taking the disrupt action to burn your own data just to crash the global economy and destroy the value of your rival's highly visible public blockchain ledgers.
To the completely optional but incredibly immersive act of scanning a physical QR code on the back of a card to claim verifiable proof of exploit on a real-world living digital database.
And finally, to the realization that the game sitting on your table is actually open-source software, waiting for you to download the repository, hack the Python scripts, and recompile the reality of the game itself. Every single rule, every physical component, every line of flavor text is engineered from the ground up to completely immerse you in the fantasy of the darknet.
It represents a remarkable achievement in tabletop design, actively blurring the rigid lines between the narrative fiction of the game and the physical digital reality of the players sitting at the table. And honestly, going through these sources leaves us with a final thought to mull over, something to seriously consider long after we log off and leave the terminal today.
What's that?
If a tabletop game uses open source software to generate its physical playing pieces, utilizes local artificial intelligence to write its flavor text, and leverages real-world domains and databases to cryptographically verify its fictional hacks, the boundary between the game and reality is effectively erased. At what point does sitting down to play this game stop being a mere simulation of a cyber attack and start becoming an actual practical exercise in hacking a global connected community?
Whoa. That is genuinely something to think about. I might need to go check my firewall settings. Until next time, stay safe in the terminal.